Welcome to this segment of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Right now our guest is Dr. Craig Evans, and he's written a new book, a definitive book. It's called Jesus and the Manuscripts. And this book is very scholarly and very important for people to realize just how reliable the New Testament is. Dr. Evans teaches at Houston Baptist University. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. Thank you so much, Dr. Evans, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you.
Sure. All right, so sometimes skeptics out there in the public arena, I think of Dr. Bart Ehrman as an example, cast a cloud over the New Testament as if, well, we really can't trust that it's reliable. But in terms of other writings of antiquity, certainly around even the same time, is that fair to the New Testament?
Well, no, of course not. The New Testament is the best preserved, best attested, best witnessed book from antiquity. There's no other book that's even in the same league.
What about the Old Testament?
Well, you know, with the Old Testament being so much older, and because of the two destructions of Jerusalem in antiquity, we don't have quite the manuscript evidence. But we do have a pretty good indication, thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Before the scrolls were discovered, as you know, back in the 1940s and 50s in 11 different caves, the oldest complete Old Testament we had in Hebrew dated to the year 1000 A.D. Well, when we found the scrolls, we had Bible scrolls, Book of Isaiah in its entirety, for example, dating back somewhere between 100 and 200 B.C. Now, that's jumping back 11 or 12 centuries in time, and guess what? The text was the same. So I suspect if we had more witnesses of the Old Testament, we would see the same continuity, the same stability, a careful preservation of the text.
Okay, when you say the text was the same, what this means is that let's say there was a manuscript that was produced 100 B.C., okay, and the scholars, they copied all this down. They took one manuscript and they had to handwrite a second copy, make a duplicate. No Xerox machines, no publishing, no printing houses. Okay. And then that manuscript was tested or compared with a manuscript that was copied around 1000 AD. And the two are basically the same. In other words, there weren't a whole bunch of different changes within the two different texts. That's what you're saying, correct?
That's what I'm saying. And so, you know, the Book of Isaiah is a great example because it's full of prophecy and it's the kind of book, if anybody was tempted to tamper with the text and sharpen a few passages, maybe make them point toward Jesus or something like that, it would have to be the Book of Isaiah. Well, we went back in time to about 200 B.C., so that's a 12th-century jump back in time, and it's the same text. So, you know, and by the way, just to help our listeners understand, we have ancient texts where we have a handful of manuscripts to compare, and they have different numbers of chapters. The order is different. Stuff is missing. And so when I talk about textual stability, that's why I say the biblical record is incomparable. There are very, very few ancient texts that come anywhere close to that kind of accurate preservation down through the centuries.
All right, let's talk about the Gospels, and we'll begin with the four Gospels. Would it be fair to say that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the only first-century Gospels that we have? Would that be fair as a starting
correct.
Point? Okay.
Yep.
Comment on that. I mean, that's significant.
Well, it is, because, you know, Dan Brown popularized the idea with his book, The Da Vinci Code, that there were, I think the number given was 85 Gospels or something like that. That's absurd. There are only four that date to the first century, and then there are maybe as many as 30 others in the second, third, and fourth centuries. And so it's nothing like the way it was portrayed in that movie. But he was basing his own, it's a novel, I understand that, it's fiction. But he had been misled by some really crazy pseudo-scholarship out there that suggested there were oodles of Gospels, and Emperor Constantine in the 4th century decided which four to include the New Testament. That is utterly false.
So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're from the 1st century. It's widely recognized, to use the word you use in the book, patrine. Mark is patrine, which means it was of Peter. Explain that. What does that mean, Mark? Why?
Well,
explain about Mark's gospel.
Yeah, you know, we have this real early testimony. It's from the early second century, and several church fathers in the second, third, fourth century cite it. And this guy's name is Papias, and he's talking about something. He's such an old fellow. When he was a youngster, some of the disciples were still alive, Jesus' disciples. And so he reports, he calls them the elders, that one of them said, well, you know, Peter used to preach and tell, you know, the Jesus story, Jesus' teachings and activities in these little units, these little chunks like we would at preaching and sermons and so on. And Mark wrote them down. And then this is what people used to write the Gospels. Well, this is going back to the middle of the first century. So Peter is preaching. He ends up in Rome, which is where he does die. He suffers martyrdom. And his preaching and teachings getting translated into probably very good Greek, and Mark writes it down. And that's the substance that lies behind the Gospels. So, you know, that's pretty early stuff. And that's one of the reasons why I think the New Testament Gospels were recognized as authoritative from the get-go. And the other Gospels that people wrote later because they wanted to show Jesus in a different light, that's why they were never recognized.
Can you comment on Matthew and Luke? And by the way, it seems as if there's early commentary, early in the centuries, in reference to Matthew, that originally he wrote it in Hebrew. But explain this, if you would. Matthew and Luke.
Well, sure. Yeah, you know, Mark wrote down Peter's teaching in Greek, and I think this becomes the basis for all of the Gospels, or at least Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But yeah, Papias, the same guy, says that Matthew wrote a version in Hebrew. There's nothing strange in that. Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, did the same thing. He wrote out his account of the Jewish rebellion against Rome in the 60s. He wrote it out, first of all, either in Hebrew or Aramaic, and then a year or two later, he writes out an account in Greek. And bilingualism was common in the Eastern Roman Empire.
That's good.
So Matthew evidently produced a Hebrew or Aramaic version, which, by the way, survives for some centuries and gets quoted and talked about. And then he brings out a Greek version, and in bringing out the Greek version, he shows contact with the Petrine tradition that we've been talking about.
So do we have a copy of Matthew in Hebrew? It sounds like you're saying we don't have a full copy of it, but there are quotes from it in Hebrew from other writers. Is that correct?
Yes, we do. And here's the problem. We do, in the Middle Ages, we actually have a Hebrew version of Matthew, and we also have an Aramaic version. And what we don't know is, are these versions connected to what Matthew produced in the first century? We just don't know.
Oh, okay.
But it is interesting. We actually do have some old text to look at and talk about.
Wow. Okay, Luke says at the very opening of his gospel that inasmuch as others have, you know, set aside time to write about these events, I also want to contribute this, O Theophilus. First of all, what writings was Luke talking about? Obviously, Mark would have to be one of those things, maybe Matthew too.
Yeah, that's right. And the church preserved Jesus' teaching. We would expect that. That's what scholars sometimes call Q. It's just the German word meaning source. Now, some people run wild with that and speculate things, but I understand Q is simply Jesus' teaching that was preserved by his apostles and by the early church. So when Luke undertakes to write, he's got two or three sources he could choose from, and so he taps into the Markan material that comes from Peter. He taps into Q, and he probably knew of some other stuff as well, and he produces not only what we call the Gospel of Luke, but then, he provides an account of the early church, which is what we call the Book of Acts.
Huh. Okay, now how literate was that society, the society in which Jesus did his ministry? How many of those people wrote and could read?
Well, you know, it's been speculated in scholarship in the last 30 years that very few people could read and write. I disagree with that. And I disagree with it because what I've observed is anywhere people lived in abundance, in other words, any place there's a city in antiquity, and in those places where the weather permits, where the elements are accommodating survival, we find huge amounts of writing. It can be graffiti written on the walls. of cities like Pompeii and Herculaneum buried under the ash of the volcano, Vesuvius in 79. It can be pieces of pottery, ostraca with notes written on it. It can be actual papyri buried in the dry sands of Egypt. It can be inscriptions that we have found. Any place humans lived in any kind of number, we find just tons and tons of writing. So that tells me the idea that only 5% or 10% of adults could read, those estimations are way, way too low. And as far as Jesus and his disciples are concerned, remember, Jesus is called a teacher, rabbi, and his disciples are called disciples, which means learners. Well, I find it just incomprehensible that Jesus as a teacher can't read, or his disciples who are students can't read. That doesn't make any sense. So I suspect Jesus certainly was literate, so were his disciples, and that's why the movement he founded, we call the church, was a very literate movement that was interested in producing books, collecting books, founding libraries and schools, and so on. And it's an educated, literate movement that Jesus initiated.
Hmm. Yeah, I forgot the exact quote, but there was some early observation that the one thing about Christianity you could say is that it was a very bookish phenomenon. I mean, it was, you know, reliant on books. Books were center. That's interesting. Comment, if you would, on these other gospels, so-called, that we mentioned earlier that were not from the first century, not Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the so-called Gnostic gospels. Comment on those. What were they?
Well, yeah, you know, in fact, two of the most significant ones are in the second century, and they're not Gnostic. The Gnostic ones, I don't think too many people take seriously. They're second and third century, but the two Gospels that are talked about the most, the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Peter, of course, was written in the second century, had nothing to do with Peter. It has that extraordinary account of the resurrection taking place where Jesus emerges from the tomb, assisted by two very tall angels. The cross comes out of the tomb with him. This is a piece of reckless apologetic written in the second century to try to convince doubters that there weren't sufficient witnesses to the resurrection, just two terrified, confused women. So why some scholars take the Gospel of Peter seriously, I honestly don't know. The other one is the Gospel of Thomas, where Jesus is basically a talking head. The evidence just keeps piling up. It was written toward the end of the second century. It does not really give us an authentic glimpse at the historical Jesus. But these are the two Gospels that people, you know, your hearers, your listeners need to know that they're talked about the most, but they are second century. The Gnostic ones are very mysterious. Jesus talks about weird things. Mary Magdalene is presented as a special disciple. And, of course, this is what Dan Brown and Da Vinci Code went wild with in a very, very off-base way.
Huh. Okay, we have about a minute remaining. What else needs to be said? It sounds like the questioning and the doubting about Jesus and the whole Jesus movement is ill-founded as far as genuine scholarship is concerned.
Well, I agree, Jerry. And one of the exciting things, and my book does talk about it, is just how long the autographs, that is the original writings of the New Testament, how long they existed. And that, I think, is why the New Testament is so stable. The original copies, which were venerated and treasured, were around for at least 100 years, maybe more like 200 years, and were deliberately destroyed later by Roman authority. Mm. And when you have the original Romans or the original Matthew, and people have a chance to copy it and copy it and copy it again and again and again for 150 years, that's why the text is so stable. That's why you can't get away with trying to change the text, add a new chapter, take a chapter out, change something. You can't get away with it because there are just too many other copies that are the same based on the original. So that's one of the big developments that my book wants to highlight. The evidence, the archaeological evidence, is clear. The originals were around a long time.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Craig Evans, for writing this book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. And is there a website for the book itself or for your own studies?
Well, sure. You know, you can Google the book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, easy to find. You can go to my website, which is craigaevans.com, and my book is mentioned there as well.
Super. Okay, thank you, sir. All the best.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.